Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight featuring commentary by conservative commentator Dan Proft, liberal blogger Georgia Logothites, and Professor Art Sear of Carthage College. Our program tonight coming from our home base at the Sirius XM Studios on Chicago's Great West Side, where our phone lines are wide open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. If you'd like to email us a comment, our email address is btb@museum.tv. And for the next 2 hours, we're going to talk about primarily about foreign policy tonight. Not only Afghanistan, but Pakistan, also the problems with Mexico. Those are the principal areas of discussion, but we may get into some other areas as well, including a suggestion by Senator Patrick Leahy, who is the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, the Democrat, liberal Democrat from Vermont, that maybe there should be a truth commission created to look into the alleged wrongdoings of the Bush administration. We'll talk about that as the program unfolds this evening. But again, during the campaign, as you will recall, Barack Obama said over and over and over again in speaking out against the war in Iraq, thinking that that was a bad idea. He kept saying over and over again that the focus really against the Al-Qaeda and the war on terrorism really should be focused in Afghanistan. And this past week, he announced that 4,000 additional troops were going to be going to Afghanistan in a training capacity. And yet there are some that when they hear a president of the United States talk about 4,000 troops, training capacity, advisors, they get a little frightened because it reminds them of similar comments made by Lyndon Johnson many, many years ago. Georgia Logothites is with us tonight. She is our liberal. She is with one of the leading liberal bloggers in the United States. Georgia, troops, U.S. troops going in, even though they are trainers, allegedly, does it concern you that they're going into Afghanistan at a time when many of your political ilk, if I may use that term in a pleasant way, would just as soon have all troops come home?
Well, first of all, I don't think that that's completely accurate. I think that the progressive movement has always said that Iraq was clearly a misguided war and we never should have gotten in there and we should pull out in a responsible manner. But with respect to Afghanistan, I think progressives have consistently stated that that is the real war that we should be fighting. And I think that's why many people in those circles are applauding the president's decision to send the troops there, albeit in a training mission, because that's really finishing up the job that should have been the primary focus of the of President Bush's administration.
So the left will stay on the supportive side of that policy. I want to get that reaction from Dan Proft, our conservative commentator. Is this a short-lived support by the left, in your view?
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, the left is going through its own kind of retrenchment, just as Obama is from the campaign to his presidency. Certainly, I don't think when Obama talked about getting troops out of Iraq, he meant that we were going to keep 50,000 troops on the ground in Iraq and a slow withdrawal based on the recommendations of generals on the ground, which is what his position is now, which is, ironically, was George Bush's position. I think the play in Afghanistan is the right play. I actually think probably McCain is right that we probably actually need more troops, and some of, including Gates, have said that probably more than 4,000 troops is really required based on the circumstances of what's happening in Afghanistan right now.
Art Sear joins us from Carthage College. Art, nice to have you with us.
Thank you, Bruce.
Your reaction to the president's decision on Afghanistan, any surprise?
No, I'm not surprised at all. The insurgency has been getting stronger for about the last year with some very spectacular attacks that have been extremely valuable for propaganda purposes, as well as killing individuals, including some crucial ones opposed to Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. We had to go into Afghanistan. I think it was a moral and in many ways legal necessity after the 9/11 attacks. I think the president would have been impeached if he hadn't. And we've got to win there. The situation has been deteriorating, clearly, over the last couple of years. Gates, I think, is extremely important in this regard. He's expressed concern about lavish use of firepower, which tends to be the American way. And he's expressed very honest and I think useful anxiety about the counterproductive aspects of sending in more troops in the midst of a guerrilla insurgency. So I'm very, very glad that he's been kept on.
Georgia?
Just to correct the record back to what Dan was saying regarding the president's representations during the campaign, the policies that he's implementing now are entirely consistent with those that he stated in the campaign and that the American people voted for. He never promised that he would withdraw all troops from Iraq the second that he was elected into office. He had always maintained that it would be a reasonable redeployment of the troops, and that, I think, is what we're seeing taking effect now. With respect to Afghanistan, I think that the key point that was hit on by the other panelists is honesty. I think it's refreshing to have a president come out and say, you know what, this was a job that wasn't done, that America's policy was incorrect, and now we're going to try and right it. And it's going to take a sacrifice. It's going to take, you know, putting some additional troops there. And while that may, I think, you, as you had mentioned earlier, prompt a knee-jerk reaction from some people who just want an end to the type of military conflicts that we've been plagued with over the last 8 years, I think it's a prudent and pragmatic and a necessary decision.
One of the questions that came up, though, is whether or not there is an exit strategy, either stated or unstated, and at least in some of the things that I've read, is there is no exit strategy stated. And so some who try to draw a comparison to every foreign policy adventure we have to tie it back to Vietnam, is there a similarity in that there was no exit strategy in Vietnam, Art Sear? If 4,000 advisors is a good idea now, it is possible that 6,000 advisors might be a good idea next year, and 18,000 may be a good idea 3 years down the road. That is a possibility.
Sure. Historical analogies are extremely important, and the trick is finding the right one. In Vietnam, people are always talking about the Munich analogy, which in hindsight was clearly misplaced. President Kennedy, who was the leader who was constantly pressed by a much different, more aggressive U.S. military to escalate in Vietnam, used to say when the Army would come to him with another specific request for advisors, you know, this is like drinking. The effect wears off. It doesn't solve the immediate problem. I don't think we're faced with the same kind of enormous counterinsurgency and revolutionary movement that we were faced with in Vietnam, with the kind of outside support that proved crucial. At the same time, Afghanistan is a country that's never really been controlled by an outside colonial power, unlike Vietnam. The British were able to get some kind of modus vivendi in the 1800s, and I think that lesson is very important for us. At all costs, we must avoid what the Soviets did in the 80s.
Dan?
Well, a couple things. One, to correct George's attempt at correction, when Obama was a United States senator, he introduced a resolution to have all troops removed from Iraq by March of 2008.
Yes.
So,
and at that time that he introduced it, that was a two-year timeline, which is exactly consistent
with what he's doing today. The good news is that Obama, despite his very kind of left-wing rhetoric when it came to all things military as a candidate and as a U.S. senator, he has moved and moderated his position. He's done just the opposite on the economic front, but on the foreign.
From Knoxville, Tennessee to Oklahoma City, Oklahoma, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway on America's great radio stations, as well as XM and Sirius Satellite Radio every Sunday night. And before we go too much further with our discussion and take some calls, let us turn back the clock just a few days ago when the President of the United States addressed the nation in a press conference, talking, or actually in a prepared statement, dealing with his position on Afghanistan and the need for 4,000 more troops.
A campaign against extremism will not succeed with bullets or bombs alone. Al-Qaeda's offers the people of Pakistan nothing but destruction. We stand for something different. So today, I'm calling upon Congress to pass a bipartisan bill, co-sponsored by John Kerry and Richard Lugar, that authorizes $1.5 billion in direct support to the Pakistani people every year over the next 5 years. Resources that will build schools and roads and hospitals and strengthen Pakistan's democracy. I'm also calling on Congress to pass a bipartisan bill co-sponsored by Maria Cantwell, Chris Von Hollen, and Peter Hoekstra that creates opportunity zones in the border regions to develop the economy and bring hope to places plagued with violence. And we will ask our friends and allies to do their part, including at the Donors Conference in Tokyo next month.
Well, that was clearly the wrong clip, but again, it sets up. That was the clip setting up his call for $1.5 billion over several years, or a number of years, by as far as increased federal aid. And I would like to talk about the fact that, at least in my view, you really can't separate Afghanistan from Pakistan. I mean, they're tied at the hip, and his comments last week would indicate that you obviously. You know, Pakistan is really the key to that region, isn't it? Even more so than Afghanistan.
Well, have to think regionally, and the president has a propensity, I think, a good one so far, to appoint special envoys. Richard Holbrooke was appointed envoy for Afghanistan and Pakistan, I believe. And you want to talk about Mexico in the next hour. Ambassador Holbrooke is what our friends south of the border would call a mal hombre, a very, very tough individual, and I thought it was very creative and imaginative and sensible to pick the guy who dealt with the snake pit of the Balkans so effectively in Dayton, Ohio, and got a peace accord to deal with that very, very vexing and dangerous part of the world. He's a good choice.
But again, Pakistan, in your view, is Pakistan really the key to that region? I mean, because they have the nuclear weapons, aren't they the most dangerous nation in that region?
Well, they become the most dangerous nation if there was unrest in Pakistan, if Pakistan was no longer an ally, if Pakistan was not somebody that we would have in terms of being able to enlist that regime and those resources to address the situation in Afghanistan. So, I mean, I think because they are a nuclear power, clearly they command a lot of attention, and rightly so.
Georgia?
Yeah, I mean, Dan's absolutely right. They have the big guns, and when they do, they exert certain influence both in their region and globally. And I think what the policy that Obama announced this week evidences is a key acknowledgement of the fact that we can't solve Afghanistan without first dealing with Pakistan. And the way that we do it is not with a stick, but with carrots to the Pakistani people directly. Because that's obviously where the roots of extremism rise, out of poverty.
$1.5 billion in carrots. That's a lot of carrots.
Absolutely. Obviously, yeah. It's spread over several years. But I think that's a testament to how dire the situation is in Pakistan and how the level of unrest that we're seeing is not dying down. You know, the poverty there, the situation there for the people that may be more in tune to the type of violent rhetoric that the terrorists are offering. That's growing every day, and the amount of the problem is directly correlated to the amount of the funds.
But it seems to me that if indeed your goal, and by the way, we should mention, in fact, let's take a moment right now and play the clip that we intended to play, and this is the president talking about the increase in troops in Afghanistan.
For 3 years, our commanders have been clear about the resources they need for training. And those resources have been denied because of the war in Iraq. Now that will change. The additional troops that we deployed have already increased our training capacity. And later this spring, we will deploy approximately 4,000 U.S. troops to train Afghan security forces. For the first time, this will truly resource our effort to train and support the Afghan army and police. Every American unit in Afghanistan will be partnered with an Afghan unit. And we will seek additional trainers from our NATO allies to ensure that every Afghan unit has a coalition partner.
Going back to the relationship between Afghanistan and Pakistan, how they are linked together. And again, the $1.5 billion is an effort to basically make friends, to win the hearts and minds of the Pakistani people. And obviously the money that's going in, the increased dollars that are going into Afghanistan for the same reason. But more money is being earmarked to go to Pakistan. So somebody somewhere believes that the combustibility of Pakistan with their nuclear weapons is more dangerous than the other nations in that region. So my question to you is, as you look at where they're putting these dollars, let's put that in context to the rhetoric of candidate Barack Obama, who said during the campaign and startled a lot of people when he said, if we had actionable intelligence that said that al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden was inside Pakistan, we'd go and we would take them out. Now, everyone said, how on earth could you possibly say that? But he hasn't backed away from that.
No, well, he has. Well, when he went, Dan, and here's what he did. It was kind of an off-the-cuff phrase, but it was important. When he was interviewed by Bob Schieffer on Face the Nation, he talked to Schieffer asked him that exact question. And what Obama said this time was, yes, if it was actionable intelligence in consultation with Pakistan, we would pursue those high-value targets. That in consultation with Pakistan is a new phrase as part of the answer he gives to this question, and it's the phrase that pays in this case.
Well, I just wanted to correct the statement that he had made on the campaign trail. It wasn't that if Osama and other terrorists were in Pakistan that we would go in unilaterally. He explicitly said that if Pakistan refused to act,
right,
then we would go in, and I think that's a very key distinction.
But again, there is some indication that Pakistan has refused to act in a number of cases. I mean, that's why we're having – I mean, you know, why are all the drones going inside Pakistan if Pakistan is acting properly? We obviously don't believe the Pakistani military and the Pakistani police. We really don't believe that they are aggressively trying to root out al-Qaeda in the mountains of Pakistan. And part of what we're trying to do here is we're trying to buy $1.5 billion worth of friendship. At the same time, we've got the drones and we've got people ready to make a move if we can get al-Qaeda. Because he said, the president said on a couple of occasions last week, the goal is to disrupt, dismantle, and defeat al-Qaeda. That is the core goal.
But can we go one point that sure. Professor Sear made before, which I think is a valuable one to jump
great.
Off on
thank
this
you.
Point too, is when you compared it to not making the same mistake that the Russians made,
oh.
right? And frankly, that America made during that period where we helped the Afghan the Mujahideen
oh, yeah. CIA to repel
the Russians.
Bob Gates was directly involved in those activities right. during his CIA career.
But that lesson was, you know, finish the job after the fact, right? The lesson was help provide the seeds and the seed capital to help these nations rebuild themselves and be stable quasi-democracies.
Let's go to calls. Let's go to Steve listening to us in Tennessee on WNOX. Is it Bonnor or Bonnori?
It's Bonnor. B-O-N-O-R-E. Bonnor.
Oh, very good. And where is Bonnor, Tennessee?
About 30 miles southwest of Knoxville.
Very good. Well, nice to hear from you tonight. Go ahead with your question.
First of all, the $1.5 billion isn't spread over years, as the young lady said. It's $1.5 billion a year for 5 years.
Right.
So that's $7.5 billion. We're never going to win the hearts and minds of people by trying to buy them with money. Secondly, if Pakistan was our ally, which they aren't, they would have let this into Pakistan years ago to chase the Taliban. Third, I am amazed at how so many intelligent people in commentaries on radios and politicians completely ignore the fact that we're in a holy religious war with the Islamic factions who are now operating 35 training camps in this country to train radical people to overthrow this country. And we don't even secure our borders in Mexico. I served on the border as a Minuteman 3 years ago on the original Minuteman program, and there were people from 21 countries except besides Mexico that were coming into this country undocumented.
Steve, let me just interrupt you for just a moment and tell you that in the second hour this evening we're going to talk at length about Mexico. So we're going to kind of put a response to your question on hold, or if you want to call back. But again, I do want to get your thoughts. You say the $1.5 billion a year, and you're right. It's over a five-year period. It's every year for 5 years.
That's right.
But my question to you is, if you were in charge, what would you do? Is there something that we can do other than right. a military plan that would basically get that would affect the hearts and minds of the Pakistani people?
The answer to that is no, because we failed to do that in Korea. We failed to do that in Somalia. We failed to do that in Vietnam. You do not win the hearts and minds of people who hate you. And the majority of the rest of the world over there, the Islamics, hate us. You don't win the hearts and minds of your next-door neighbor by giving him an apple a day.
And it is your opinion that everyone who is a Muslim hates the United States.
I didn't say that. Don't quote me and say, I did not say that.
All right.
I said the majority of the people that we're fighting, and even if the majority of them aren't, we don't know which ones are. The 18 or 19 that flew into the tires in 2001 were in this country on legal documents, but phony purposes, and we couldn't even find out.
Steve, stay on the line. I'm going to put you on hold. We're going to put you on hold. I want Art Sear to respond to what you've said and give you a chance to follow up when we come back from Chicago. I'm Bruce Dumont. From Worcester, Mass. To Fresno, California and Palm Springs, California, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway. 1-800-723-8289 is the phone number. Our liberal tonight is Georgia Logothetis. She is a contributing editor of the Daily Kos. That is one of the leading left-leaning blogs in the United States, and she's proud of it. And she's been with the group since 2004, and she is Georgia 10, is your moniker. Also joining us this evening is our conservative commentator, Dan Proft. He does commentary for Don Wade and Roma. That's our morning show on our flagship station, WLS, where he also does commentary on American Idol.
That is true.
And were you pleased with this past week's American Idol verdict?
I expected it, but there's a guy named Adam Lambert that I really want off the show. So
okay,
you can investigate
okay,
that.
Adam Lambert, next
right,
one to go.
Right.
Art Sear also joins us. Art is a A.W. Clawson professor at the A.W. Clawson Center at Carthage College and formerly with the Chicago Council on Foreign Relations.
Thank you, Bruce.
And also a syndicated columnist for the Scripps Howard News Service.
Thank you very much.
1-800-723-8289. Steve is listening to us and on WNOX in Tennessee. Steve, are you still there? Are you there? Steve is not there, but Art's here. We want to give you an opportunity to respond to sort of the blanket
right,
indictment of this $1.5 billion trying to win hearts. So let me ask you for Steve, because Steve's
yeah,
not here. Where has $1.5 billion bought us true friendship historically?
Well, I think foreign aid has been extremely important since the end of World War II. There's no short answer to that. I do want to emphasize you don't have to butter up Bruce Dumont to be on his program, but I agree with your approach to him, which is, okay, you're upset about what's going on in the world, so what do we do? I think we all should be very grateful and keep in mind that had the Bush administration done what Al-Qaeda wanted, hoped, and probably predicted, struck out massively with military force after 9/11, the government of Pakistan, which had nuclear weapons, could well have toppled. Both India and Pakistan have nuclear weapons, and there's a real possibility of a nuclear exchange in that part of the world. Through prudent action, working with all countries from a regional perspective, we've helped maintain stability in Pakistan. They have something like free elections, a nation which is rightly seen as one of the most corrupt in the world.
Are they better off now, though? Because, again, at the time of 9/11, mm-hmm, when President Musharraf was in charge, we gave him billions of dollars then. We
sure,
we bought our friendship then, and we believed that we were buying an aggressive partner in the war on terror. And to some extent, we did. I mean, some of the really big catches happened because of Pakistani intelligence, correct?
Given the virulence of Islamic fundamentalism throughout the region, including in Central Asia, the former Soviet Union, and the violence of these groups, I think the Pakistan leadership generally should be commended for being our ally in this case.
Even though they played, as every world leader has to play, to their own domestic political matters. And that's something that a lot of Americans
right,
don't necessarily buy, that, you know, just because we give them money, they can't look too much like whores, if you'll pardon my French.
You're reinforcing my point,
yeah,
that the domestic constituency is important in a way that was not the case when they were a hardline old-time military dictatorship, which they were until fairly recently. The money isn't going into numbered bank accounts primarily. It's going for roads, schools, infrastructure, the kind of improvement in well-being of the average person, which is our ace in the hole in dealing with these terrorist groups.
Dan, before we take another call, and I want to get George's response to this as well, whether you're talking about Mexico or Pakistan or Afghanistan or you name the country that's a problem country for the United States or for the world, corruption, these are all corrupt governments. How can we as a nation send a signal, and how can we try to fight corruption on foreign soil? Because if you're not fighting corruption on foreign soil, all of the money that we send, or much of the money that we send to these countries, is going to go into a sinkhole. It's going to be spread around corrupt governments, including Iraq. What we might add that country in the list as well. Mm-hmm. What can we do? How can our carrot and stick be a little more effective just on the issue of money getting to where it should go?
Yeah, I mean, part of that too is particularly in Iraq, where you've had a lot of stories. You didn't hear too many of the stories about the roads and bridges and hospitals that were built in Iraq, and there was a lot of that done. Talk to anybody in the service, and they'll tell you who served in Iraq. I think there's a couple things. I mean, one, it's you got to lead by example. So the private or quasi private enterprises that go to do work on these foreign soils, on these foreign lands, whether they be Halliburton or private military corporations that provide security. I mean, they need to uphold American principles. They need to be organized. They need to be competent. I mean, a lot of this corruption, it was also a manifestation of incompetence and not managing these projects well. And that's not unlike the federal government. That's where you see a lot of money thrown down a rat hole, is when you just are bad managers. You know, incompetence is a form of corruption too. It's still robbing the taxpayers of value for their dollars, just in a less direct way.
But are we believable on the world stage? Is the United States government believable on the world stage to sit and point fingers at the corrupt actions of other governments? I mean, we have defense contractors that buy off members of Congress. Mm-hmm. I mean, where do we get off being holier than thou?
I mean, you bring up a good point about, how can we approach corruption on foreign soil when here on our own soil it's such a clear problem, especially here in Illinois. And I think,
But on a world stage, we're pikers compared to corruption in the rest of the world.
Well, I'll just point to one example.
We're not great, but we're pikers.
Yeah, we're better than most other countries, which is the best answer to your own question, Bruce. And in fact, most of the rest of the world is coming more and more to resemble us in terms of reasonably fair elections, a rule of law.
Well, and
there are lots of measurable indices are encouraging.
Georgia was making a point.
And that's the key point that, yes, we have our issues here, but, just to say one quick anecdote from Iraq. When we had sent our money over there, there were articles recounting the fact that people were playing football with stacks of, $100 bills in the street. And the money and the accountability just wasn't there. And going back to what Dan had said about competence as a fundamental measure of accountability is key. What happened in Iraq and the reason why so many billions of dollars were lost in that endeavor was because we saw the key positions were staffed because of politics. For example, many people don't know that some 20-something was put in charge of Iraq's entire economic system, the entire restructuring of that economic system. Somebody that was barely out of college because he happened to be in the right political party. I think what we're going to see with the monies that are spent now in Pakistan and Afghanistan is a bipartisan approach to accountability, where the person that's in charge of the money isn't the one that's well-connected, isn't the one that donates the most money, but is the one that has the most trust to do the job.
Well, I'm not sure at all that we're going to see that. I'm hopeful that we see that. But here's the thing. Establishing first principles, right? Here are the first principles. Here is the ethos. Now, do we fail to live up to our own first principles sometimes? Of course we do. Do we have individual congressmen that contravene the law? Of course we do. But it doesn't change the principles. So here is the standard that we all agree is the standard, and then we all try and live up to it. Rather than saying, be like America, or rather than saying, we're kind of wagging our finger at you, or we're holier than thou. No. Here are the principles. If you agree with these principles, then codify them in terms of your operation, and you try and live up to them just as we try to live up to them and sometimes fail. I think that's a better way to provide discourse. The other quick point I'll make, though, too, is, in situations like Pakistan, when, as Professor Sear was saying, you've got 70% of the domestic population that is pretty anti-American, you're making some deals with the devil, right? The idea that you can enforce your moral code on some of these individuals, or that you're not making compromises on the margin to advance the overall mission, is Pollyannish.
Let's go to Steve. Let's go to Eddie, listening to us in Chicago on our flagship station, WLS. Eddie, go ahead.
Thank you. A couple of points. We haven't figured out how to modernize the madrasas, so they can respect other religions, just so we should respect their religion. And also the poppy fields in Afghanistan, we should be spraying that with some kind of pesticide so we can cut that thing in pieces.
You're talking about the drugs.
Right.
Well, again, we talked about it on this program about 6 years ago. I mean, when the U.S. military had an opportunity to destroy those fields, they should have destroyed them then, not worry about it now.
Well,
there was an opportunity to aggressively make a very strong statement against drugs, and the United States policymakers chose not to do it then. Now they're surprised that the problem is back again, and now they're going to try to eradicate it.
Yeah,
it was in a better position when they could have done it.
But the problem is always going to reemerge. I mean, just as when we eradicate cocoa fields in Colombia, that doesn't stop the movement of cocaine. As long as, you know, supply creates its own demand, and as long as there is a worldwide marketplace for drug trafficking, you know, the poppy fields will grow again.
It's a good time to bring up that durable duo. Not exactly a song and dance team, but very durable in policy, Richard Nixon and Henry Kissinger. They paid Turkish, the U.S. government, directly and indirectly, paid Turkish farmers in the early 70s when the French connection through Marseille into Manhattan and the rest of North America was from Turkish heroin growers. They paid a premium for farmers to go into legal pharmaceuticals for firms like Abbott and Baxter and others. That's worked. It's one reason why there was growth in production elsewhere in the world. Dan is absolutely right. I've mentioned this from time to time, including a good old New York Council on Foreign Relations seminar held in Chicago not long ago, and a couple of Washington wannabes sneered at me. But I think it worked then. It might well work now. You're going in with defoliants. It's a good way to alienate the population. We learned that in Vietnam, among other good lessons. These fields are often hard to find. I think providing a business-like incentive to move elsewhere, as Kissinger and Nixon did, is a very smart move.
We've got to pause. 1-800-723-8029. Lots of callers on the line. We'll hear from them when we roll on from Chicago, from coast to coast and border to border every Sunday night, taking America's political pulse. I'm Bruce Dumont. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Lots of callers on the line. Let's go to Bob in Bakersfield, listening to us on KERN from Kern County. Go ahead, Bob.
Hey, thank you for taking my telephone call. Unfortunately, one of your guests was talking about President Nixon and stole my thunder, but that's okay. You were talking about Afghanistan and our influences over there, and it's been a proven fact that, you know, over the last 500 years, you know, French and British colonial interests, they basically bought off whoever had control of the most radical elements in that country, and you know, it was done rather successfully in Afghanistan and Pakistan, or India, later became Pakistan, and we just basically have to resort to a carrot and a stick kind of foreign policy. You know, it's unfortunate, but it's effective, and we have to figure out a way in order to, you know, to keep ourselves on top of our national security interests, given the fact that the instability that is going on over there. And I don't know what else other than to say that.
Go ahead, Dan.
Yeah, I just think that the conversation we had previous to the break, this whole thing about buying friends and buying or winning hearts and minds, I think that's a faulty premise. I don't think that's what we're trying to do. I think we're trying to buy and, as Professor Sear was pointing out with his example, incentivize stability, right? It's not about us, you know, kicking back and going to the movies together. It's about incentivizing stability in these dangerous regions of the world. And I think that's some of what this foreign aid is for, and certainly
But part of it is it is building communities. It is building schools. It is building hospitals. It is building an infrastructure of institutions whose primary goal is to enlighten people and to make their lives better.
But those are institutions that tend to help stabilize communities.
Yes.
That's precisely the point.
Right. Go ahead, Bob.
Didn't John McCain say during the campaign that we run around giving money to those people that hate our guts? I mean, that's basically what we do. We buy people off that can't stand us.
Sarah Palin said that. Sarah Palin, I believe, said that.
Candidates say lots of things, and it's important to keep in mind that foreign aid historically is extremely unpopular in this country. People tend to greatly exaggerate the amount of money that's involved. It's been trending down in real terms since the 60s.
Bob in Bakersfield, stay on the line. We're going to bring in Bob in Des Plaines, Illinois. Bob, are you there? Bob in Des Plaines, Illinois, are you on the line? No, he's not. Are you on the line? Who's on the line? Which Bob is on the line?
Bakersfield.
Neither one is on the line, so we'll get back to our discussion. Anyway, Bob in Des Plaines was talking about that we should be a little more alarmed at the $7.5 billion, that it wasn't just $1.5 billion for 1 year. We should be alarmed at that expense. Should we be alarmed at that expense? And my question to you, Art, is when you look, and I believe it was $10 billion that we sent to Pakistan in the wake of 9/11, did we get our money's worth for that $10 billion?
I think we did. Islamic fundamentalists, Al-Qaeda, have not taken over the government of Pakistan. It's a very fragile state. I'm frankly surprised they've been able to have elections that have worked reasonably well. A country that has a history of authoritarian dictatorship and a history of corruption. They also have a very strong military trained from the British, trained by the British. They have, in fact, been an ally of ours in different ways over time. They're a member of the Southeast Asia Treaty Organization, which you might say only a professor would come up with. But because of the commitment of a very harsh military dictatorship to the cause of anti-communism, John Foster Dulles was able to line them up. It's important.
I'm talking about Pakistan now, and their police department, their security forces, and their intelligence operations, very strong, sympathetic ties to the Taliban before September 11th and right today.
It's a very dangerous situation. You're absolutely right. At the same time, I think for that reason, there's cause for some optimism. And again, any kind of foreign aid is unpopular in this country traditionally.
Bob in Des Plaines is back with us. Bob, are you there?
Yes, Bruce.
Very good. Sorry we got you cut off. Go ahead.
I appreciate your effort to get me back on. Bruce, something I'm caring about, and I couldn't help but pick it all up now. When this original debate here started, or conversation, it was with President Obama stating clearly that he was going to take $1.5 billion each year for 5 consecutive years and contributed to Pakistan for aid.
Right.
Now, the first thing the young lady did, who's on your show, said was, oh, well, that's spread over a period of time, just cavalierly. And I said, whoa, it wasn't. It was $1.5 billion.
Right, someone called in and corrected her on that.
But how come nobody made an effort? You even said it was a lot of money, $1.5 billion. Yet, when you said it, when you found out it's now 5 times as much, there was nothing at all. And I got the impression, has the government been successful in indoctrinating us into a billion here?
No. The point I'm making is, I think $1.5 billion is a lot of money.
So right.
$7.5 billion is a lot of money. And my question that I just asked Art while you were calling us back was, we gave them $10 billion. We were giving all kinds of money away after September 11th. We were trying to buy friends and influence people all over the world. And Art basically just said that he thought, in his opinion, we probably, that $10 billion was wisely spent. Now,
Given what's happened since.
We'll have a lot of people that will disagree with that. But your
tone indicates how emotive this issue is, Bruce. I mean,
it is.
People get excited about
it. And I think if the concept of buying friends is something that I think a lot of people listening to the show can understand that. When you give people money, you expect them to do what you ask them to do. That isn't necessarily the way it works around the world.
Well, human nature is complicated. There's also loyalty involved.
And
I'm very glad
Dirksen loyalty,
has come
we've gotta,
up.
We've got to say
Dirksen.
Farewell. That's Art Sear, Drudge and Logothetes, and Dan Proft. They've been with us in hour number one. They'll be back with hour number two. If you're listening to us on radio, we'll be right back. If you're watching us on television, see you soon. Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics. with occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, professors, public servants, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight featuring commentary by conservative commentator Dan Proft, liberal blogger Georgia Logothides, and Professor Art Sear of Carthage College. A program tonight coming to you from our studios at the SiriusXM studios on Chicago's Great West Side, where our toll-free lines are open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. And if you'd like to email us a comment, our email address is btb@museum.tv. Well, we have been talking about what can we do as a nation to make nations around the world, primarily in Afghanistan and in Pakistan, like us or respect us so that they won't all get together and gang up and try to kill us. This is one of the major concerns that we have as a nation and our foreign political leaders have. One of the issues that I would like to throw out for discussion, I'm sure we will get discussion about it, and that is, we also talked about recently, that whether or not we hold ourselves up as this pillar of pure activity, and we try to tell the rest of the world how to run their lives, how to manage their business, how to root out corruption in their own midst, when maybe we haven't been as good as we could have been in rooting out some corrupt practices that we have in this nation. And I put this in context with a recommendation by Senator Patrick Leahy, who is the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee. He has come up with an idea, as well as John Conyers, the veteran Democrat from Detroit, Michigan. They want to have a truth commission that would look at all of the alleged indiscretions and illegalities and abuses of power of the Bush administration, have investigations, have prosecutions, and root out those that have perhaps done wrong in the name of the United States. My question to my panel this evening and to everybody listening and watching the broadcast this evening, if we were to do that, is there something positive that would come out of that? Positive in that the rest of the world would look at us airing our dirty laundry in public, thus maybe having greater respect for us? Or would they think we are fools? Dan Proft.
Well, no, there was nothing good that's going to come out of it. I mean, the idea of a truth commission, that's one of those oxymorons that politicians like to use. This would have nothing to do with truth. This would be a political witch hunt by radical left-wing clowns like Patrick Leahy and John Conyers to prosecute policy differences that they were not able to successfully defeat during the 8 years of the Bush administration. Ironically, some of the very policies that they thought were abrogations of the law, the way the FISA court acted, extraordinary rendition, the treatment of prisoners at Gitmo, Obama's adopted those positions. And in the case of Gitmo, the Pentagon did a report that said Gitmo complied with the Geneva Convention. So, I mean, this is absolutely nothing more than folks that have had too much syrup, like Patrick Leahy, and are not serious about the actual problems facing this nation.
Georgia Logothides, our liberal blogger tonight. Georgia, what do you think?
Well, I think that Dan is fundamentally wrong in saying that nothing good can come of this. I think the key distinction of whether something good can come out of it is how Senator Leahy and Representative Conyers conduct the commission, whether you want to call it a truth commission or accountability commission. I think if the focus of it is not on individuals and whether or not this specific individual did something wrong and whether they should be prosecuted to the full extent of the law, I think that if the focus is, was this policy correct in the sense of, what was the mistake that we made from the government's perspective in implementing this? Was the way that we set up Gitmo the most efficient way of doing it? What were the mistakes that we made? And from there, we learned from our mistakes how to not repeat those mistakes in the future. If we turn a blind eye to the past 8 years, how will we know not to make those same grave mistakes in the future again?
Art Sear of Carthage College, my question to you, and then I want to go back to our other panelists. If we were to do this, if this were to unfold in a congressional truth commission or an independent commission looking at all this actions, how would the rest of the world view it? And is there a way in which the rest of the world would view it in a positive way that could help the image of the United States?
I can't think of one. It would be a sign of weakness and would reinforce the intense partisanship that since Vietnam has spilled over into the foreign policy arena and has created tremendous problems.
So a bad idea?
I think it's a very bad idea. It echoes the truth commissions that were set up in South Africa after the end of apartheid, a very different environment on very different issues. I don't think we should have a serious examination of the Iraq War and other foreign policy decisions of the Bush administration. But unfortunately, Congress, which is very good at investigating specific problems and issues and airing the laundry, so to speak, in these partisan times especially, I think it's a very bad idea to go to that.
Haven't truth commissions, at least in Central and in certain countries in Latin America, haven't those truth commissions led to a greater understanding and a greater respect for human rights?
Mr. Dumont, we are not a banana republic. These are countries evolving in our direction. I think we have the moral as well as legal high ground in the world, despite our mistakes. And I was and am very much against the American attack on Iraq and occupation. But I don't think that this is a wise course in public policy. You know, we were talking earlier about foreign aid, and you reflected very directly the very emotional feeling so many Americans have. Of all the intelligent, able people who've run AID, a very durable agency, I'm only aware of two really successful AID directors, Peter McPherson in the 80s, a former banker from Bank of America, and David Bell way back in the 60s when it was a much tougher job with much more money. Dave, who is what we used to refer to as a dedicated public servant, I worked for early in my career at the Ford Foundation, one of the most impressive people I've ever met. I want to emphasize that because I've met a lot of people at this point in my life. I think setting the right kind of example, the right kind of leadership example, starting with Obama and going on to senators and congressmen who can look beyond intense partisanship is the way to lead this country.
Dan Proft, a follow-up to you. I mean, again, right now we're dealing with an aggressive left-of-center movement led by Patrick Leahy that wants to look at the alleged indiscretions of the Bush administration. But again, if the shoe were on the other foot and we had conservative leadership in Congress that wanted to look into the misdeeds of Democrats, is that not good? I mean, granted, I'm not suggesting that Whitewater is on the same par as Abu Ghraib, but again, a lot of time and effort was spent trying to look at the mistakes and violations of Democrats.
Well, Abu Ghraib was investigated. I mean, people were held accountable. I mean, Haditha is being investigated and ultimately a bunch of soldiers
specifically
were exonerated.
Specifically torture in other ways?
Well, right. I mean, Haditha was the charge of massacring people. Abu Ghraib was the charge of torture. Gitmo, the charge was torture and maltreatment of prisoners that contravened the Geneva Convention. And Pentagon report came out and said, actually, no, it complied with the Geneva Convention. You know, I mean, I think the bottom line here is, again, I mean, the irony of Obama adopting a bunch of Bush policies with regards to extraordinary rendition and FISA and Iraq and so forth. But the other thing is there are institutions set up to deal with people who break the law. There are federal prosecutors. There are courts of law to handle these matters as they have when these issues have arisen. This would be nothing more than a political witch hunt.
Let's get reaction. 1-800-723-8289. Should there be investigations into the conduct of the Bush administration when it comes to torture and Abu Ghraib and a number of other things? And should Congress get involved in it? 1-800-723-8289. Bruce Dillon back in Chicago. Thanks very much for joining us tonight. Let's go to calls. Let's go to Nima, who's listening to us in Bakersfield, California, on KERN. Go ahead, Nima. Thanks for joining us tonight.
How are you doing tonight?
Okay.
I was just going to make a point that the Truth Commission funneling money into Pakistan and increasing troop levels, all of that is only skin deep. We must go to the root of the problem, which is the U.S. foreign policy. There needs to be a complete overhaul of the way the U.S. conducts its foreign policy, like most immediately the Palestine Israel situation. And I think if you look at how certain countries, for example, Iran, a Shiite country, is aligning itself with Sunni countries around the region, supporting insurgents in Iraq, who a country that it's had many beefs with, there needs to be a complete overhaul of the U.S. foreign policy. And I noticed that no one's really made that suggestion.
Well, we just recently had an election, and the American people had an opportunity to send signals and change foreign policy. And I guess the question that I would ask everyone around the table is, How much significant change can there really be in a foreign policy? Dan Proft has made the point that a number of the things that Barack Obama said he was going to do when he was running for office, he hasn't really done so far, or there's been no significant change in that. There are some that would suggest that what he's doing, that he may be just trading, you know, troops in Iraq for troops in Afghanistan, and yet he spent a great deal of time talking about it during the campaign. So I don't know, after you have almost a year and a half of candidates running around the country telling people what they want to do in foreign policy, the voters decide, and there doesn't appear to be significant change. Dan, let's get everybody to respond on this question.
I mean, not only has Obama, like I said, not done some of the things he said he would do, he's reversed course. I mean, he's adopted Bush administration positions. And frankly, on some of the things, that's good. And I think he's moderated his actions are more moderate than his rhetoric was during the campaign, and that's appropriate. So that's a good thing. But I will say to the caller's point that, I mean, part of the problem, whether it's on foreign policy or a whole host of issues, the problems facing this country, the parameters of debate do tend to get very small. The distinctions, you know, political parties are kind of geared, at least in this country, the two-party system, to blur a lot of distinctions and differences. And so you don't have necessarily as robust debate. You don't have kind of system change conversations, rethinking how we order our foreign policy, rethinking how we order institutions that are not working in this country. So I think to his point about a broader conversation, I think that's always productive, and it's in short supply in this country right now.
And so we are basically playing our politics between the 40-yard lines.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right.
All right. Georgia,
I guess as a threshold matter, I mean, Dan's referenced the fact that Obama's adopted many of Bush's foreign policy positions. I mean, that's just a talking point. I think it's simply not brought out by the facts.
It's also the truth.
Well, it's not, because I think one of the fundamental things that we've seen in these just 2 months that he's been in office is a dramatic reversal in course from the posture of the Bush administration, which was essentially shoot first, ask later. It was very much, we're the aggressor. We're going to label you a axis of evil. We're going to label you an enemy combatant. We're going to refer to you the war on terror and label any country that has even tangential relationship to Islamic fundamentalism a country that may be part of the war on terror. What we've seen is a much more pragmatic approach in these last several weeks, which is that, yes, we have the nation's interests and security interests at heart, but we don't have to have that debate with the same type of language that the Bush administration has been using, which was very antagonistic, which was very much isolating America from the international dialogue. We've seen that the way that Barack Obama has approached Pakistan, Afghanistan, it has been with an open hand, but with also the reassurance that if you don't help us in this regard, then there is always the American force to back that up. But we're not going to confront you first with weapons. We're not going to confront you first with force. And that was what he said in his press conference that you
showed earlier. But how does that differ from what George Bush did in the wake of the September 11th attacks? Insofar as his relations with Pakistan, he didn't threaten Pakistan with military action. He went to Pakistan with open pocketbook, mm-hmm. just like Barack Obama's going mm-hmm. with open pocketbook, almost as big a pocketbook as George Bush did. So there was a similarity to how presidents act. I mean, not everything that George Bush did was bellicose.
No, of course not. And especially when we're dealing with general American international policy. We can't obviously change certain policies that have been in effect for 20, 30, 40 years if they have shown signs that they're working. But that doesn't mean
I do believe that there's a lot of people listening to the program this evening, and Nima may have been one of those callers, who when they went and they cast their ballot for Barack Obama, they expected within a week after being sworn in as President of the United States, General Petraeus was going to be at the White House. And in fact, I think Barack Obama said, "I'm going to bring these guys in, you know, within a week or so, and give them new marching orders." Mm-hmm. I don't think the average American listening to the show this evening, who wanted to get out of Iraq in a hurry, I don't think they're necessarily happy campers tonight.
Not to mention, oh, by the way, I'm still waiting for somebody to refute the fact that he has changed course and adopted the Bush position on FISA, on extraordinary rendition. He's walked it back in on Gitmo. I mean, these are things that have happened. This is true. I mean, this is what he said and now what he's done.
What he said about Gitmo, he said, you know, we will not torture. We're against torture.
Right.
But, you know, if something happens, we may have to. He didn't say torture, but he said we may have to do other things.
I think that represents a change. I think the caller makes a very good point, because I was impressed, not surprisingly, at how little actual foreign policy discussion there was during the campaign. I think it had a bearing during the primaries. McCain was the only Republican, I think, who was consistently for the Iraq War and for the Bush White House, just as Obama was the only one who was against the war. But in fact, we had very little foreign policy discussion during the campaign. And that was one reason why Obama won. The foreign policy debate they were supposed to have was upstaged by the Wall Street rescue. Hyperactive McCain went back to Washington. Polls show people trust the Republicans more on foreign policy generally concerning defense, use of force, than Democrats. McCain may have lost the election because of that move.
We are now going to go to Lebanon, Oregon, listening to us on WGAL. Mike, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, that's Lebanon. It's different than Lebanon.
It's quiet. It's quieter, too. It's a lot quieter,
it's
I'm
quieter
sure.
I hope so.
Yeah, we should go there
right away. Did I get the call letters right? Is it WGAL?
KGAL, that's right.
KGAL, that's what I thought. It was west of the Mississippi. Should be K. Go ahead.
Okay. You know, I think this is just a complete goose chase. The fact that they want to go back and look at the Bush administration and how things went wrong, it's a sham. At least Whitewater took place while Clinton was in office. This is after the fact. Truth of the matter is, they're still.
No, Whitewater was before he took
still
office.
Running against Bush, and Bush is not here. They don't have any substantive ideas. Mm. They are empty, completely empty.
But let me ask you this question: as an American citizen, as an American taxpayer, and again, in this particular case, we're talking about investigations into George Bush. But think about if it was a Democrat, as a citizen of the United States. If your government does something wrong, do you want to know about it? Yes or no?
Well, yes. If the government does something wrong, I expect to find out about it. However, in the current climate, to make a new independent commission to go after this, I don't see the value in it. We've been rehashing the transgressions of the Bush administration for the
separate the name George Bush from my question, and that is, if the government has done something wrong, how do you know if the government has done something wrong unless there is some type of investigation? And
well,
it may be a congressional investigation made up of generally. Commissions generally are made up of Republicans and Democrats. I mean, a good example is what happened in 1976 when Senator Frank Church from the state of Idaho, and we have a lot of people listening to us on KBOI this evening, he had an extensive investigation into the allegations of illegality and violations of civil rights, civil liberties, by the CIA. He had an investigation, and he demonstrated that there was a lot of really bad things that were done by the CIA during that period.
Well,
knew about it.
I'll give you an Obama answer. I was only 8 years old when that took place. But I can rest assured, if it was a Democrat, it would be very hard to find out about. If it was a Republican, the mainstream media would put it on the front of every story until...
Well, I would agree with you, sir, but I would also say that I think that Bill Clinton was one of the most investigated presidents we've had based on what he did in office and out of office. Art, your thoughts, you were sort of, naysaying my comments about the Church Committee?
Senator Church very much wanted to become president. There's no easy answer. There are certain things
that's
the country has to do
it.
For
that's why he did it?
Sure, that was part of the... Sure, he was grandstanding. It was very sensational.
Do you think that's how... Do you think that that's how
politicians
you would
become, want higher office?
That's how you would win, a, you would win the presidency by,
absolutely.
By castigating the CIA.
Absolutely.
Well,
absolutely. In the atmosphere of those times, sure. The public hangover from Vietnam. Dwight Eisenhower, I think, was the greatest president since World War II. Ike had the luxury as well as ability to keep everything secret and everything private. There are certain things that should remain secret. The CIA's record during Vietnam, in fact, was very good compared to military intelligence. What Church did was he gave special attention to things like Mongoose, this effort to assassinate Fidel Castro that started under the Eisenhower administration and was greatly accelerated into a wild goose chase.
It was also one of these things, again, we're off the track, but it was also, it was sort of important to know, I think, that the CIA was in bed with the mob. To me, that was important. Back shortly from Chicago. From Racine, Wisconsin to Cucamonga, California, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway. Thank you very much for joining us tonight. Georgia Logothetis is here. She is our liberal blogger. She is Georgia 10, and she is the contributing editor of The Daily Cost, one of the leading liberal progressive websites, blogs in the United States. Also joining us this evening is Dan Proft. He is a conservative commentator on the morning show Don Wade and Roma here on our flagship station WLS Radio in Chicago. And Art Sear, who is the A.W. Clawson Professor at Carthage College and also a syndicated columnist for Scripps Howard, joins us this evening on our program. We have lots of callers on the line. Let's head east to Tom in Youngstown, Ohio, listening to us on the Big 57, WKBN. Go ahead.
Another great program, Bruce.
Thank you.
Let me say, by way of disclosure, I used to be a Democrat. I'm kind of disenchanted with both parties at this point, but I vote the candidate. To your woman guest who said that as far as any truth committee is concerned, that she would like it from the standpoint of learning from history and correcting problems and so forth, would she include in that the investigation of the financial situation? And I, you know, understand the names Barney Frank and Chris Dodd are kicked about as far as being partially culpable in that situation.
You know, my position is, and obviously as somebody that is outside of the establishment, absolutely anything that can be done to shed sunlight in the darkness that is the halls of Congress, I think should be done. And, you know, you brought up a couple names, obviously, that have some stories attached to them. We need to have the utmost trust in our public servants in the sense that when we give them our tax dollars, that they're dispensing them in our interest and not in their own interest. And
well,
I
agree with you. And, you know, if that's your perspective and it's not one-sided, then I'm all for it. And quite frankly, you know, when you're talking about cost, I don't think the cost involved in investigating these things would be as great as the problems caused as a result of some of these things. And so, yeah, if we can correct some of the problems and put some of these people on notice, I think it would be a good thing, and I'd like to hear from your other guests, Bruce.
Tom, I'm going to do that, but I want to ask you a follow-up question, which was the question I asked about 20 minutes ago on this program. If there was a full-fledged investigation into all of the alleged misdeeds, and I say alleged misdeeds, of the Bush administration, would that in any way be viewed in a positive way by people around the world? Would anybody say, you know what, this country is really neat, you know, they're washing all their dirty laundry in public, or would they think we're fools?
You know, I think it depends upon who's looking. In other words, if it's people who like to be underhanded, then they'll probably be viewing us as fools. If it's people who like sunshine and like the things done above board, I think they would have greater respect for us.
Does it make any difference to you on investigations? Does it make any difference to you who does the investigation?
Yes, I think it should be non-political from the standpoint of don't let Congress do it where they can just grandstand and be in the limelight. I think it should be an independent bipartisan or tripartisan or maybe nonpartisan committee.
What about the media? Again, because a lot of people who listen to this program are just sort of knee-jerk negative to the media. Can the media do an investigation like that?
Absolutely
or is that
not.
Why not?
Because for the most part, The television media is more liberal. The radio media is more conservative. I don't know how you can blend the two.
Well, the fact that you have two, doesn't that automatically blend it? What's your answer to that question, Dan?
Can the media do it?
Yeah.
Media does it all the time.
Well, the broad world of media. I mean, we have Fox News, we have CNN, we have, you know, you can say maybe it's lopsided, that there aren't as many conservative, channels as there are liberal channels. But why can't the media do it?
Well, I mean, look, I think the
media... They did Abu Ghraib.
I think the media does do some investigative and expository stories that end up having merit and end up making the bridge over into the legal arena in terms of prosecuting wrongdoing. But, I mean, to rely on the Fourth Estate as the lead agency for this kind of... task? I don't think so.
Let's go to Paul in Racine, listening to us on WLS. Racine, Wisconsin, just a stone's throw from Kenosha, Wisconsin, where Art Sear holds court.
A hop, skip, and a jump. We don't throw stones between Racine and Kenosha.
Go ahead, Paul.
And like Art, I'm digging out after some unfortunate snowfall overnight, but regardless of that,
let me say that what
is proposed in these investigations is just ridiculous and an absolute joke, and here's why. The Democrats fundamentally will never get over the 2000 election, and thus they hate Bush, they hate the former president, and they're going to do anything in their power to discredit him historically. They did that through the 8 years of his administration, and as your conservative said, President Obama is doing is a lot of the same things that former President Bush did. The other thing is, think about it. When you look at the Democrats for 8 years, all they've done is they've just opposed anything President Bush has done. They have shown no leadership. And this, again, this just goes more to that point. There's no leadership here. They want what they want to do. They want to continue to make former President Bush the issue, continue to deflect attention away from President Obama. And I bet you, and this is the other part of this, if you were to look at the liberal mindset, Georgia, if you were to put a poll up on your blog that said, do you think former President Bush should be tried as a war criminal, the majority of the people on your blog would agree with that. But again, that's the liberal mindset. Anything they can do to discredit President Bush is what they're going to do. So this should really come as no surprise, and it would be an absolute joke.
You know, by the way, you mentioned, I'm going to let Georgia respond to this, but, you know, you mentioned, a poll on the Daily Kos, and maybe the percent for favoring prosecution would be very high. But USA Today recently took a survey. 38% of those that responded to a USA Today poll thought there should be prosecutions if they were warranted, and 24% of the people said there should at least be an investigation. Yeah. Georgia?
Well, I would encourage your listeners to go to our blog and see that the type of site that we have is certainly...
Georgia, how do you know I haven't been there?
Okay, absolutely. Well, the idea is that our mission, and specifically the progressive movement, our aim is to have a pragmatic approach to government. And that's what we haven't had in the last 8 years. We've thrown pragmatism and common sense out the window. Do we believe that George Bush has done certain things that may not have been in complete accordance with the law? I certainly think he has done it. I think many people would agree. However, the pragmatism kicks in and we realize that it's not in the best interest of this country to go ahead with that type of persecution against an administration that isn't even in power anymore.
Well, Paul, your final word.
Well, here's the other thing. Again, this goes to show you the liberal mindset here and what you're going to have for at least the next couple of years. You notice how Georgia said she referred back to the last 8 years. It's not looking forward. It's wanting to look back. And, my God, if there's anything in this country, whether it be foreign policy, domestic policy, the economy, that we can't afford to do is look back.
Paul, let me just ask this question then. Then I'm hearing you say loud and clear is that if there is skullduggery by any administration, regardless of what, take the politics out of it. If there's skullduggery and illegal activity and violations of constitutional authority, that once an administration makes it out of office, we should never look and we should never question their activities.
Bruce, the problem here is, though, there has been none. I mean, when you look at Gitmo, and you can argue all day whether or not it was a good idea, do you really, truly, in your heart of hearts, believe that these people's rights were violated?
I'm talking not specifically about this, I'm trying to separate the concept of looking just at George Bush, which is you look at it from a political prism. If you thirst for truth, and this is a truth commission, the Church Commission, which my colleague Art Sir didn't think was a good idea, this was a Democrat looking into both Democratic and Republican activities by the CIA.
It was a select committee of Congress. It wasn't some special new commission.
No, it was a select committee, but they were not just looking at what the Republican president was doing. The same thing with the Warren Commission. They looked at things that had a Republican and a Democratic slant to it.
Yeah,
and we've had commissions, Bruce,
the Warren Commission was a product of the Johnson White House, and I don't think that President Johnson's behavior in overseeing the Warren Commission, given your views on that subject, I'm a little surprised you'd bring it up.
No.
The Warren Commission is not a model of objective analysis.
No, I agree with that.
And neither with this commission, based on what Georgia just said. And I'd like to hear why she thinks this, which is that I do think, this is what you said, I do think that Bush broke the law. Okay. For example.
Well, I don't believe, obviously, that domestic spying is in accordance with our Constitution or with the FISA regulations. We're not going to get into it. I'm more than happy to have a legal debate on these issues. You know, I'm obviously well-versed in them, and I'm glad
and
to engage Dan, and I'm an attorney, and so I studied the issue thoroughly. However, going back to your caller's point about not looking back, that's exactly the point that I had made earlier in this program, which is if it's a type of commission that looks to hang people for their past actions, I don't think that's in the best interest of this country. But, for example, the contractor abuse in Iraq, those billions that were wasted, that's a nonpartisan issue. And if Americans are so outraged about AIG and getting ripped off their tax dollars about that now,
but that's
also something that needs to be looked
into. But that's looking back. That's against the principle, how
can we prevent the mistake in the future, though? These contracts,
so do you
want to
look back or do you not want to look back?
But you
it
have
seems
to look
to me
back
that
in
everybody
order to
wants
improve.
It. Once your term is up, you get away with whatever you got away with, and nobody wants to look at it. Truth be damned. Back shortly. From Charlottesville, Virginia, to Grand Rapids, Michigan, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway. Let's go back to calls. Let's go to Randy. He's driving on the road in Louisiana, listening to us on XM Satellite Radio POTUS. Go ahead. You're on the air tonight.
How you doing?
Okay.
Okay, as for, like I said earlier, as for the gentleman that said it's nothing but a witch hunt, the other gentleman that called in said it wouldn't be nothing but a goose chasing, and listened to Georgia just a minute ago, basically what they're all saying is that it don't matter, as long as they get out of office, it's all right to commit a crime. It don't matter if you've been in office or you're out of it. My opinion, if you've done the crime and you get caught at doing it, even if it's a couple of years later or whatever, you still need to be justified. Because if you're not justified, you will not, you're giving the future politicians the permission to say, hey, I'm going to come and be a crook, be a politician.
Dan Proft.
First of all, that is absolutely not what I'm saying. If somebody has committed a crime, they should be prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law, whether they're in office or out of office, as we have a lot of experience with here in Illinois with our governors, which I'm fully supportive of. So that is not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is the vehicle, this Patrick Leahy-led Truth Commission as the vehicle to bring light to any possible criminal wrongdoing is the wrong vehicle. That's my point.
We don't want to put Patrick Leahy in charge of our court system directly. We don't want to put Barney Frank in charge of our monetary policy,
I presume, right?
Congress has a different function, and judicious examination of the law is not one of them.
Let's go to Robert in Murraysville, Pennsylvania, also listening to us on POTUS XM Radio tonight. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, thank you. Enjoy the show.
Thank you.
I think investigation, by its very nature, has a retroactive aspect. Obviously, something has to occur before it can be investigated. Now, the investigations that we're talking about are investigations of allegations of criminal wrongdoing, violations of domestic statute violations of international law as codified in treaties that we're a party to. I think that to characterize what was done with Haditha and Gitmo, to call those investigations or to call those exonerations anything other than whitewashes is being charitable. I think there has to be an investigation, but by its nature, an investigation has to be one that gives everybody confidence in the integrity of the process. For that reason, I believe that your conservative guest is absolutely correct that to have Congress in charge with something as highly charged and as partisan as an allegation of criminal conduct by members of an administration per se, you're not looking at something like the Church Commission where you were dealing with primarily the focus on a governmental agency. You're looking at an administration in a number of areas. And I think that the partisan implications of that cry out for either a panel that is bipartisan and that people can have some confidence in its results, or a special prosecutor. Those processes are designed for this. A five-minute session with everybody getting some face time in a congressional atmosphere. To me, that is rife with disaster because all you're going to get are partisan distractions, and you're not going to get at the meat of what's actually being investigated.
Very good points. Art Sear has got a comment.
Yeah, I agree with the caller, and by implication, what he said about Dan's points. However, Guantanamo is going to haunt us collectively for a long time within the legal process. A big reason why it hasn't been shut down is there aren't many people left there, and it's almost impossible to find a country that's willing to take a large percentage of these men. Rumsfeld made a fundamental ethical as well as strategic mistake when he said they have no rights. When you're in a wartime situation and uniformed military, meaning our people, are involved, you've got to follow the Geneva Conventions. Mm-hmm. You've got to follow our legal system. We made a big mistake, and civil lawsuits as well as investigations by various legal authorities are going to continue to plague us on this.
Before we run out of time, I said we were going to talk about Mexico tonight. We've only got a few minutes left because we've gone off in some other directions, and we've had good discussion about it. But Hillary Clinton, Secretary of State, last week said that it's the U.S. thirst, the insatiable thirst for drugs in the United States. It's fueled the drug violence in Mexico. Do you agree with that? And what should the United States government be doing more, above and beyond what they're already doing, to deal with the issue of Mexico, of violence in Mexico, and the drugs coming north and basically the guns going south?
Well, that's part of what Clinton said. That's part of it. But the big part of it is President Calderon's really aggressive posture to try and attack these drug cartels and put them out of business. I mean, that's really what has spiked the violence. That's part of the concern, and certainly from those folks in border states talking about violence spilling over into their communities, I'll take them at their word that probably more resources need to be devoted at the border to address this problem. But the other thing that's a real problem beyond just the drug cartel-related violence is other terrorists coming in through that porous border. I mean, Hezbollah and other people that are in kind of working in concert with some of these cartels to get their people into this country. That, to me, is much more concerning.
Georgia?
I think it's interesting whenever conservatives mention our porous southern border, they don't mention our porous northern border. It's just as easy for a terrorist to cross on the south as it is for them to do so in the north. That being said, I think Senator Clinton, Secretary of State Clinton, brings up a very important issue in the sense of it's a supply and demand issue. And the less Americans here crave those drugs, the less demand there will be for that market to be done. However, that's a long-term problem. That's not going to be solved in the next 8 years. That may not even be solved in the next 20 or 30 years.
We will talk more about this next week. Georgia Logothides, thank you very much. From the Daily Kos, Art Sear, Clawson professor at Carthage College, and Dan Proft, our conservative commentator tonight. We thank you very much for joining us. Sorry we didn't get a chance to talk more about the Mexican problem. I predict it will not be solved by next Sunday night, so we will be talking and also picks up on some things that Peter Bensinger, the former head of DEA, said on this program a few weeks ago. Good guess. Maybe we'll have him back next week. Our thanks to Tom Veracruz and Ben Stewart for the assistance in the production of this program. I'm Bruce Dumont. Good night from Chicago.